You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 30th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author Tim Wise on race, Republicans, maybe I can get him to talk about Breitbart, and more. Also on the program today, incredibly busy weekend for Occupy Wall Street. Massive protests, marches, an attempted occupation in Oakland, 400 arrests at least. In New York last night, a march in solidarity with Oakland led to 12 arrests. And on Up with Chris, New York Attorney General Schneiderman basically not just crediting only Occupy Wall Street, but he basically said that he attempted to describe what's happening with the financial fraud unit that he's been appointed to, the federal one, which has been, like I said, over the past week, the most important thing that came out of that State of the Union address, in my estimation. And speaking of, I mean, attempting to build confidence in those of us who have been paying attention to this fraud that has taken place not only since the financial crisis in the mortgage market, but prior to and caused the financial crisis, attempting to build our confidence in his agenda on this financial fraud unit, the agenda of the financial fraud unit. And he said, look, this is bigger than President Obama. This is because of an uprising by the people across this country. And undoubtedly talking about activists who have been working on this front for over the past year or 2 years. But without a doubt, in not so many words, crediting Occupy Wall Street. And so the implications of this movement continue, as does the actions. We will play that audio later in the program of the disruption of the foreclosure auction that took place in Brooklyn last week. And hopefully tomorrow on the program we'll have Okfo Sho, who is the one of the live streamers from Oakland, to give us the real story of what happened in Oakland. And either tomorrow or Wednesday we'll be talking to Jeff Smith. A little bit of controversy in the Occupy movement. We will get to that as the week continues and as this show continues. Also, more and more, the failure of austerity as an economic tool to revive growth is beginning to get more and more debunked as the data rolls in. We will talk about that in the program. And we'll probably touch on this with Tim Wise. But you remember how Ron Paul had all those racist newsletters? This is going to come as a shock to you, but he was aware of what was going on those newsletters. I'll give you a moment to recover yourself. Maybe get a glass of water if you're feeling a little faint. We'll be right back with Tim Weiss after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the program someone I've been meaning to interview for at least a couple years now. And I don't know why it's taken me this long to get off my duff. Anti-racist writer, author, essayist, author of 6 books, Tim Weiss. You can find him at timweiss.org, on Twitter at Tim Jacob Weiss. Thanks so much for joining us, Tim.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So there's a bunch of stuff I've wanted to talk to you about for I think it was 2 years ago, maybe it was more, but I saw you at give a great talk at Netroots Nation that has always stayed with me about the resentment that is fueled by racism towards what we consider the welfare state, if you will, that developed really when shortly after the Civil Rights Act, sort of the social emancipation, or at least the institutional emancipation, I should say, or at least the near institutional emancipation, I should say, of African Americans in this country. But before we get to that, I want to let's just start because you've been it's involved in the arguments going back and forth regarding Ron Paul's candidacy. And I think there's a good entree into at least some of these issues. It seems even more moot now, particularly after the recent revelations that I think, you know, dispel any doubt, if there were those who had them, just as to his involvement in these racist newsletters. That apparently it's very good business, but just give me a sense of just of your response to the progressive, in some quarters, embrace of Ron Paul.
Right. Well, I mean, what's incredible to me about it, and I did write an essay that went, you know, semi-viral about a week and a half ago about this, is that, you know, you have progressive folks who are willing to overlook not only 95% of this man's platform, which is utterly reactionary, but to do that all for the sake of, you know, the 5% in which, you know, many of us on the left might agree with him. But they're willing to do so in spite of the fact that among the things that Ron Paul is worst on, you know, is the notion of basic civil rights enforcement. I mean, this is a guy who, when he looks at the old footage of civil rights protesters sitting on stools at the Woolworths or at the Five and Dime store or the soda fountain or whatever, trying to get served in 1960 during the sit-ins, and then being hauled off of those seats by police who are enforcing the property rights of the white owners, he looks at that and says, well, the property owners are in the right. I mean, he ultimately is saying that they were correct for having those folks hauled off of chairs because the white man's property right outweighs the right of black people to be treated like human beings. Any progressive who is willing to say, yeah, you know, he's sort of a racist, but, or yeah, he's sort of a sexist, but, because he's also said, for instance, that, you know, sexual harassment shouldn't even be illegal. If women are harassed, they should just quit their jobs and find another job. Anyone who's willing to overlook that and still call themselves progressive, it really frightens me. It seems to me that if there's going to be a litmus test in this country about what makes one progressive, basic belief in civil rights protections and equal opportunity ought to be among them. And here's a guy who is very clearly on record as having said that the civil rights laws should never have been applied to private companies and that private business owners should be able to do whatever they wish because their rights are paramount. Anyone who believes that, I just don't see how they can consider themselves progressive, or anyone who would support someone like that, how they can consider themselves so.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Ron Paul in the sort of the aspect that gets glossed over, because I for one, appreciate at least on one level his call for civil liberties in terms of what's happening with things like the Patriot Act, things
sure.
like the NDAA, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera. He has a problem if federal authorities are
right.
going into that lunchroom. He has no problem with state or local authorities pulling black people out of that
right.
lunchroom.
Well, not only that, but you know, even his thing with the TSA. I mean, his son. You know, I live in Nashville, and his son Rand was, you know, stopped and I guess, you know, was subjected or tried to be subjected to a pat down here at the Nashville airport last week. And, you know, it became this huge call of righteous indignation. Oh, my God, they're going to pat down a United States senator. And then Ron Paul, of course, raised money off of that. But what was interesting was that in his condemnation, you know, his position is not that we should not have tight security checks at airports. That might even include that. He just wants, and he said it himself, he thinks airport security should be turned over to private
right.
companies. If those private companies decide that they want to do full body nude, you know, picture scans and save the pictures for their own edification, if it's a private company, his answer would be, well, if you don't like it, don't fly, or start your own company and be more competitive than them, or, you know, take the bus instead of going in the airplanes if you don't. I mean, what kind of, you know, he's for civil liberties in the abstract, this sense that he doesn't want the quote-unquote big bad federal government to intrude on our persons, but he doesn't care if a profit-making business does the same thing and leaves us with no choice but to be subjected to their whim. There's nothing remotely progressive about that.
It also, I've never heard him complain about the tremendous the experience of black men in the urban centers, who they are subjected to that type of pat down, not for flying, but for walking on the sidewalk.
Right.
You know,
right. And even though he would say, as he did when he, you know, when he started getting criticized for the newsletters, now he's saying how anti-racist he is because he's against the war on drugs and the disproportionality of it toward black folks. So he would say, oh, but I do care about that. And yet the truth is, once again, his position is that the states ought to be able to make their own drug laws. The feds should basically get out of it. So he doesn't have a problem with perhaps 50 different wars on drugs, or, you know, as I said in the piece somewhat sarcastically, 49, you know, Vermont may legalize. So, you know, congratulations, hippies, you know, you can get high in Vermont, but everybody else where black folks actually live in large numbers, to think that they're not going to be harassed by state or local police, that they're not going to be harassed by private security if things get privatized. I mean, it's absurd. His concerns over these issues, and I think progressives need to understand this, is far less about some principled opposition to dehumanization, some principled opposition to the mistreatment of people on the basis of color, and simply more about this sort of somewhat slavish devotion to this Ayn Randian objectivist, the individual is all, and, you know, the state should not do this. But he really doesn't care whether, you know, smaller government officials at the local right. level do those things, or whether private companies do.
Right. He's more of an anti-federalist, I think, than a civil libertarian, in my estimation.
Yeah.
But, and you know, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with the concept of a litmus test in this context, and I'll tell you why. Because I want it, because I know that you you know, I've listened to some recent interviews you've done. You had a great interview, and I think we've either linked or posted to the interview you did on Blacking It Up.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the value of Ron Paul, it's a very complicated a question, I think, to a certain extent, because I do I do understand why people are promoting at the very least his positions relative to President Obama's when it comes to empire. Right. His promotion, his at least the narrow playing field that he allows for himself in talking about civil liberties right. in context to President Obama. And then, you know, the question becomes, like, you've said in the past that that President Obama has really required, as I think all leaders do, yeah. that progressives make him do more things. Expand on that a little bit, because I want to head into that, because I think to a certain extent, the yeah. promotion of Ron Paul's positions on some level, I don't think he's the best spokesperson for it. I don't know why people aren't promoting Rocky Anderson, let's say, in that context.
Right, sure.
But is sort of meant in some way, I think, to do that very thing, to push President Obama in a certain direction.
Well, and the only thing I think we need to recognize is that, in the case of Ron Paul's handful of positions that we can call progressive, it's not working. I mean, the reality is the president is not responding to this candidacy, which is not going anywhere, by saying, oh, I really should rethink those drone attacks, or, yeah, you know, I really might ought to rethink policy in the Middle East, or, gee, yeah, I really should stop the war on drugs. It's not happening. You know, when Ron Paul brought those things up, there's just, like, silence in the debate halls, and then they go on to something else. That doesn't mean you can't push the president to those places, but I doubt very seriously that President Obama is going to be pushed to a more progressive place by someone who stands far, far, far to his right on 95% of all issues. If that's going to happen, it's going to have to happen from his left. And a good example of that, although I think there are flaws and there are problems and all kinds of things in the movement that need to be worked out, the one thing that Occupy has done since going back, you know, to September when it really kicked off, is that there has been, I think, for the first time in many years that I can recall, the inculcation of this discussion about income and wealth inequality among presidential candidates. I mean, Obama himself has spoken about it in recent months, not as much as I'd like him to, and not, you know, with sort of the intentionality about what's going to be done about it. But even the fact that that narrative is starting to become more popular, so much so that even Mitt Romney, 5 weeks ago, made the statement, which was pretty laughable, but he still made it. You know, I'm not a typical Wall Street guy. Well, what does that mean? And would he have said it 4 years ago? Well, he didn't. Would he have said it a year and a half ago? Well, he didn't. And so it says to me that if we want someone to move left, we have to not really so much push them as pull them there. I think that's far more likely. So instead of relying on Ron Paul to raise these handful of legitimate issues, we should be absolutely appalled that he's the one who's getting the most traction for them, when it should be our job to do it. Whether or not it'll work, we don't know, but it is our job as progressive and radical folks to raise those subjects.
Right. I mean, I agree with that. I think Corey Robin had a piece suggesting that the emergence of Ron Paul as the only spokesperson on the left, you know, supposedly carrying this banner on the left, is problematic because of who he is, but it's also problematic insofar as there's no one else on the left who's raising those issues.
Well, I mean, there are people, of course. I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus has raised them for years. Lots of folks on the left of the Congressional, you know, the Progressive Caucus, and those folks have done it. Now, they don't get the attention. And, of course, in part, that's because Ron Paul's running for president. I suppose if it were a Democratic primary and Kucinich were running, or Bernie Sanders were running, or something, you know, someone who was clearly to the left, then maybe it would be. But in lieu of that, you know, the reality is we've got to take that dialogue back, because otherwise it gets associated with the kind of fringy thinking that Ron Paul is so famous for in every other area. You know, it's like everybody hears us talking about, you know, drone strikes, or hears us talking about the war on drugs, and they think, oh, yeah, they probably want to, you know, go back to the gold standard and, you know, a bunch of other sort of pseudo-conspiratorial things that Ron Paul believes in. So, you know, it's incumbent upon us to not really praise him for raising the issue, because I think that just strengthens libertarianism and he himself. But I think we've got to just say, look, we've been out here saying this stuff for many, many years, and now that this guy's saying it, we just want to remind you whose agenda this is. It's not the Libertarian parties. It's not the Republican Party. It's not conservatives. You know, it's the left.
I want to address something else you talked about in that interview as well, about the idea of President Obama's success or failure in some regards will be racialized. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I said, and I think it's really important for folks to think about, even if they ultimately, you know, decide to disagree with my take on it. You know, I'm from the South, and I think that as a white Southerner, I have a sensibility sometimes, as do a lot of white Southerners, around how race plays out, that sometimes white folks elsewhere don't. People of color, I think, all know, and those of us who are white from the South know, that when something happens in which a black person doesn't have to be president, it could be the head of a company, it could be the principal of a school, it could be the chief of police in a particular town, or a mayor, you know, does something which is seen as evidence of incompetence or failure, if the narrative of their term in office or at the head of the institution is seen as a failure, unfortunately, because of the way that we, you know, racially generalize about people of color in this country, that ends up being seen by a lot of people, not everyone, but by a lot of people as a group-based failure. In other words, the failure is somehow ascribed to that individual's identity. In a way, it's not when a white person screws up in the same way. So, you know, George W. Bush, the fact that he was notorious for mispronouncing every fifth or sixth word out of his mouth, and everyone sort of, even those who liked him, knew he didn't always come off as the most intelligent guy in the world. Nonetheless, that doesn't stick to white folks as a group. No white person would hear him mispronounce a word and then sort of like slap their knee and go, oh, come on, man, you know, you're ruining it for all of us. But folks of color know that if President Obama were, you know, so given to mispronouncing words and making huge errors of basic, you know, vocabulary and syntax, that it would have been seen differently. All the research says that people of color have far less wiggle room. And so my concern is that if, and this is something for progressives to think about, if this presidency goes down in terms of its of the popular narrative as a failure, that is going to have an effect not just on, you know, his legacy as a president, which isn't really our concern or shouldn't be. It's not necessarily just a problem for other people of color running for office. It's going to be a problem for black folks trying to get a job down the road from where you live, at the mall, at the bank or whatever, because unfortunately, failure when it is black or brown sticks in the white mind, according to the research on this matter going back 15 or 20 years, and ends up being ascribed to everyone in the group. Same thing happens to women, I should point out, as women. If a woman does something which is seen as a failure or seen as incompetent, it affects other women. That doesn't mean that we don't have an obligation or that we shouldn't criticize the president when he does something we disagree with. Like I said, we should. We should pull him to our position to the extent that's possible. But it means we just have to be aware of the way in which we issue the critique. And I think, you know, if we're not aware of that, then we may be adding to sort of the racial burden that this individual carries and the burden that will then be placed on people of color generally after he's gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's very easy. I mean, it's impossible, let's put it this way, to imagine a President Obama if candidate Obama had three wives, or
yeah.
If
yeah.
President Obama had a Swiss bank account, or
right.
I mean, there's just the list goes on and on. I mean, he had to thread a needle as a candidate. I think
right.
that certainly you would have far more latitude as a white person. Now, with that said, you know, so it's really, you know, this puts progressives in a very difficult position, because
yes.
I happen to be one of those people who, and I appreciate that President Obama's rhetoric and his
yeah.
disposition has changed,
yeah.
and you see it reflected at least slightly in
yeah.
personnel, but probably not as much as I would like.
Sure,
since September anyways, and
right.
And I'm not convinced, you know, I guess the real question for progressives now is
right.
how much do we buy into that change for those of us who perceive issues of economic populism, at
right.
least narrowly construed on the left, how much
right.
do we buy into that change, and
right.
where is the line where we know that we're beginning to cut against some of our progressive values or our progressive outcomes that we want to see?
Right. No, I think, look, we have to be very clear when we disagree with the president. The fact that he happens to be a man of color should not in any way make us, you know, resistant or reluctant to do that. But what I think we have to be careful of is the tone of the critique. In other words, if a critique comes across as one that questions, A, someone's competence, B, someone's basic decency and humanity, C, someone's propensity for, let's say, violence. A lot of the criticisms of him as the head of the empire, for example, which of course he is, as is any president, sort of, you know, refer to him in this, like, this bloodthirsty warmonger, et cetera. And, you know, the problem is, if that's the critique, given the association in much of the white mind between blackness and violence, it has a different effect than when the same thing is done with a white president. That means maybe we issue the critique of the foreign policy, but we have to watch the wording. If you criticize him for being incompetent or being stupid or being a liar or dishonest, as I've heard some do as well, not only on the right but on the left, it triggers associations about competence slash incompetence and its association with blackness. So it's not about not issuing the critique. It's remembering that certain words, certain concepts, certain ways of critiquing trigger stereotypes. There are other ways to critique policy, right, that are not nearly so personal. And this isn't just in this country. I remember when I went to Bermuda to do some work on these issues a few years ago, and much the same was happening. A black premier was being criticized for being corrupt, right, which for a lot of white Bermudians is a trigger for the belief in black criminality, or was being criticized as being incompetent, which triggers stereotypes about ability or intelligence. And what I was saying at the time was, look, if you don't like what the premier's doing, you know, you certainly are entitled to speak out, but just keep in mind, it needs to be about policy, not about him as an individual, as a human being, as a president, because if you do that, of course black folks in Bermuda are going to think you're racist, whether or not that's what it is, because it triggers those associations.
You know, I mean, it's an interesting dilemma, because there are certainly some aspects, I would say. I mean, if President Obama was white and had pursued the same agenda, you know, the idea that he is, basically midwifing the policies of essentially the 1% or the banksters, if you want to call them, is, I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's the reality. I mean, he's surrounded himself with these people.
Right.
The implications, of course, are different, because he didn't, you know, I think his dynamic to them growing up and through the ages and even as he addresses them now are different because of his race.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think, again, it's just a matter of the tone. It's about the way that we issue the critique. It's about trying, I hope, to stay focused on the policy and to always make the point that, you know what, the reality is, as long as we're an empire, which we're going to be until movements change that, presidents, you know, nobody is going to be elected the head of an empire and then voluntarily, without substantial pressure, dismantle the empire. No one is going to be elected president in a capitalist, you know, patriarchal, white supremacist system and somehow not cater to capitalism or patriarchy or white domination, unless that is changed from below. So I think we just need to remember how change is made. Elections matter at the margins. They are significant. We ought to engage in them if we want, but we always have to remember that voting and elections are tactical, that the real work is what goes on the other 364 days. And if we're doing our job the rest of the 364 days, what happens on election day won't be nearly as important. If we're not doing our job the other 364, then it won't matter who wins on election day. Things will be awful, you know, and that's the thing I think to keep in mind.
I think that's a great point. I think that's one of the best things about Occupy Wall Street, frankly, is that it has reminded us of that very dynamic. And I want to move on, but to put a point on this. So when you're talking about choosing that language in a more careful way than we would if it was another president, you're talking about it from a tactical standpoint in terms of us wanting a society that where every person, regardless of race, has more opportunity and equality.
Right, exactly. And I think the tone that we take, you know, does affect that one way or the other.
All right. I want to turn to the stuff that you've been that you've written about and you've talked about for years that I find really fascinating. This concept that the demonization of things, and this came up, I guess, with Newt Gingrich calling President Obama the food stamp president, and the ongoing sort of demonization of the unemployed in this country. We know that for blacks, the unemployment rate is five, six, seven times higher, you know, nationally than it is for whites. The demonization of the unemployed, we're seeing it in many states now. If you're getting unemployment insurance, you got to take a drug test or something, you know, these type of movements. Tell me about the roots of this and how there's this undercurrent of raciality. I'm not sure what the word is for this.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, you have to understand the history of this. If you go back to the Great Depression, so now let's go back to the 30s or the 40s even, and you start to think about the way that in mid-century, beginning earlier in the 30s and extending all the way really to the late 50s, government spending was viewed. It's very different than it is today. You know, it sounds as if to some people we've always had this argument that conservatives wanted small government and liberals wanted big government, and that white folks in particular, being more, you know, perhaps conservative in the South and elsewhere, wanted small government. But during the Depression, you will find it very hard to locate any white folks in history who were not themselves quite wealthy, who opposed government intervention in the job market or the housing market. They know if they were working class and white, which is what, you know, 95% of all white folks were at least, that, you know, state intervention, government spending, anti-poverty programs, government intervention in the so-called free market is what saved them and their families. So there was widespread support for those programs, and that doesn't really change until the late 60s and early 70s. Now, what happens between the 30s and the late 60s and early 70s? Well, very simply, for the first 25 to 30 years or so of those programs, those big government initiatives, the FHA loans, the VA loans, the GI Bill, jobs programs, et cetera, most of those programs were essentially off limits for anyone who wasn't white, because when FDR signed them into law, he had been threatened by Southern racist white senators, most of them in his own party, that they would not support the New Deal unless the provisions were written in such a way as to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for black folks to be able to participate. So for 30 years, big government was racialized as being for white folks. And so white folks didn't have to think to themselves, oh, I bet those people are going to abuse the programs, because those people couldn't even get the programs. Beginning in the late 50s, early to mid 60s, because of the civil rights struggle, but also what was called the welfare rights movement and others, people of color fought and gained access to some of the same programs that white folks had already had access to. And it is precisely at that point where the public perception of social spending, the public perception of programs intended to help the have-nots and have-lessers, becomes a perception of people of color being the ones getting help. It is precisely at that moment that public opinion begins to shift, and you begin to see white folks turning against the very programs that one generation, two generations earlier, they knew were important and which they supported. And so Martin Gillens, who wrote this great book many years ago, Why Americans Hate Welfare, documents in a very academic but yet readable way that as soon as the media imagery of the poor and the so-called underclass came to be black and brown folks, that's when the public support for whatever was thought of as welfare changed. And I think today we have to understand the consequence of that, which is why I spend a lot of time on this in my book that just came out, Dear White America. I talk about the way that, ironically, you have right now millions of white Americans who are facing foreclosure, millions of white Americans who don't have a job and are trying to get unemployment insurance, and now they are experiencing some of this demonization. You know, you've got presidential candidates running around bashing people for being out of work for so long, as if somehow, you know, they're purposely sitting around not wanting to work. And I'm sure for a lot of white folks, they're trying to figure, white working class struggling people, they're trying to figure out what they did wrong. Well, the answer is they didn't do anything wrong except be indifferent for the last 40 years as this narrative was spun that basically bashed the poor because the poor were seen as something other than white. And so now the irony is you got millions of white folks who need the same programs, need the same interventions, need the same care and concern that people of color have always needed but never received, and it's not there for them either. And I think those of us on the left need to make this connection very clear if we're going to push an economically populist agenda, to understand that the reason that that isn't working right now, or the reason that that isn't prevalent as it should be, is because social spending, the whole notion of social welfare, has been so thoroughly racialized over the last 40 years that it is preventing many white folks from acting on the basis of what would be in their own interest, just because they're so sort of we've been so programmed to want to stay ahead of somebody else who we view as undeserving. And if we don't get rid of that mentality, we're all going down.
So tactically, how do we deal with that? I mean, what is the pushback there? Do we simply just, when we talk about poor people now, we only talk about white people? I mean, what is the tactical?
I think we want to say very clearly, we need to talk about when this shift happened and link it so people understand, you know, there's a reason that you associate government spending with racial transfer schemes, because you were told to believe that. That's what politicians have been saying. That's what they've been playing upon for years. And, you know, it's just like any advertising. It works. There are companies that spend hundreds of billions of dollars to convince you to buy their toilet paper, their toothpaste, their tennis shoes. And if we can be taught to buy consumer brands after seeing an advertisement 10, 11, 12 times, which is what the research on marketing says, then surely we can be trained to buy into race and class stereotypes that we've had drummed into us not 10, 11, or 12 times, but for years and years, and for way more than 30 seconds at a clip, you know, the way commercials for consumer products are. So it's not that we're bad people. It's not that we're racist and classist people at our core. It's that we have been given this image over and over to the point where sometimes it gets in the way of understanding how we have to have solidarity with people of color as white folks we do if we're going to be able to pull out of the kind of economic mess we're in. And what I'm afraid we usually do is sometimes we push the economic populist argument without attending to this racialized thing, whether it's Thomas Frank, you know, in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I think he very deftly but unfortunately skirts the issue of race in why economic populism hasn't worked or hasn't caught on. I think a lot of authors have done that. Jim Hightower, who I have a ton of respect for, but yet at the same time, in his writing, he doesn't talk a whole lot about the way that race has been at the core of this propaganda. And I think unless we take it on head on and make the point that it's going to be very hard to get the kind of solidarity across racial lines that we need for working people to display in order to really change that system.
Yeah, I mean, if people want an example of that, at least on the right, you know, pick any Rush Limbaugh show from 2009, 2010, and every single day it is about Obama's slush fund that he's giving to black people.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's almost like a cartoon.
Well, you know, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh at that time during the healthcare debate, it was rather obvious, right? Glenn Beck goes on, I remember it was late summer, I guess, of 2009, and, you know, says on at least one occasion that I saw that the healthcare reform bill really wasn't about healthcare, that it was just the president's way of getting reparations for slavery for black people. I mean, why would you? That's a statement which intellectually makes no sense. I mean, what kind of reparations do you have to get sick first to get paid? That's just asinine. But the reality is, when you say it, it's a very brilliant political thing that you're saying, ah, see, he's doing it for those people. Remember, he's taking your money and he's giving it to them, or he's giving it to the quote unquote illegal, you know, immigrants, the undocumented Mexican, I mean, whatever, you know, and every single time these things are discussed, that is the kind of imagery that they play upon deliberately. And the research says it's the kind of thing we see. I mean, there's this brilliant study that was done of several countries in the Western industrialized world. And I reference it in my book, Colorblind, and maybe in Dear White America also, I can't recall. But the study found that the single biggest factor that differentiates the United States from all those Western industrial quote-unquote democracies that we like to compare ourselves to in terms of the size of the social safety nets here versus there, the main factor that limits safety nets here, according to that research, is the difference in this country versus those other countries in the perception that racial others, and especially black people in the case of the U.S., will take advantage of and abuse the programs. That actually goes further to explain opposition to social safety net spending here than any other factor, bigger than the history of the labor movement, bigger than, you know, cultural conservatism, bigger than Protestant ethic, work ethic differences or whatever, that the actual perception of undeserving black folks taking advantage of the program, so to speak, is actually the single biggest factor in explaining why our safety nets are smaller. And again, the irony meaning that now millions of white Americans who need those safety nets don't have them and don't even realize why they don't.
And that dovetails with research that shows that people's aversion to taxes is a function that they are afraid the money that they pay in taxes is going to go to help people who are, they perceive, lower than them on the economic or social strata, and not a function of they think they're going to be a millionaire someday.
Exactly, and which is why in the 50s, when taxes were far higher, I mean, the highest tax rate in 1957 was 91%. There were 18 tax brackets that were higher than anything we have now. And yet there was no widespread anti-tax revolt or anti-tax movement because folks felt like, well, I'm paying the taxes, but I'm the one and people like me are the ones getting the services. Mm-hmm. So that's okay. It's only when that perception changed that all of a sudden the attitude changed.
So when you say that we have a racialist, I guess, culture, maybe that's the wrong term, that's what you're referring to, that this notion of race is sort of so interwoven in our culture that it affects every sort of policy, or not every, but the vast majority of policies and questions that we address on a daily basis.
It affects any policy that touches on the so-called public good, because the whole notion of public goods has been racialized. So whenever you use the term public, I mean, if you think about public schools, public transportation, public housing, public services, when President Obama used the phrase the public option, I got very nervous because, of course, on the one hand, I'd rather we talk about single payer, but he says public option, and I know the way that people hear public. They hear public and they think of certain people, typically low income and disproportionately of color. It is a trigger word, and so I feared when he said it that was the association an awful lot of people would make, and of course, it was the association that an awful lot of people made.
I got a couple more questions. I appreciate your hanging with us so long. I don't know if you saw this story recently, but it fascinated me. There was a report out that came out, I think, a week or two ago that that controlling for education, controlling for financial situation, controlling for everything. It's been found in this country that black people are pushed into Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Well, this is small bore stuff here, so forgive me, folks. Pushed into Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which is a far more onerous form of bankruptcy than Chapter 7. And there was some implication, if not like a direct statement in the study, that showed that like it was a function of the perception of values that black people had, that they were more obligated to fulfill. They had more of a moral obligation to actually make their creditors whole in a way than white people were. All right, folks, for you freebie-ers, that is all you're going to get of that interview. The interview went on for another 10 minutes. We particularly talked about Tim Weiss's experience with my best bud, Andrew Breitbart. He's not really my best bud. But you can't hear that because I'm not letting you, because you're not a member. So, sorry. You're going to have to join at majority.fm. Hey, well, what's that jingling in your pocket? Is it a quarter and a dime? That's how much it would cost you every day. Just 35 cents. You know what else you can, or you could take that 35 cents and spend it on nothing. I don't even think that would be enough to fill your parking meter. Or you could take that 35 cents, that quarter and that dime. Every day, just pull it out of your pocket, put it on the table. That's what I paid for this amazing show that I listen to every day. 35 cents. And you know what? You have that 35 cents every day, just business days. At the end of the month, you'll get change back. Yes. So you'll have 35 cents. You put it on the table. You spend it on getting unparalleled quality of political content and entertainment every day. And then at the end of the month, you'll get change back. Now, you won't technically get change back because I'm not going to ask you to actually pay it's $10 a month. That seems like a lot. But 35 cents? That seems like nothing. You get an hour and a half show, or you just make sure that your 40 minutes that you listen to every day doesn't go away. Majority.fm. Join now. Please. Please. Do it for your kids. Do it for my kid. Just do it for my kid. Just forget my kid, actually. Just do it for me. All right, folks. See you tomorrow.